Hello and welcome to episode 216 of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this episode, we hear from Seda Demiralp. She is Professor of Political Science at Istanbul's Işık University, and she's also just been appointed as a non-resident scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington. It's great to have her on the podcast because before the recent local elections, she authored a number of insightful articles in Turkish based on public research she had been involved in that detected widespread disillusionment among the electorate, perhaps giving clues about some of the dynamics feeding into the eventual results. Of course, those results saw President Erdogan's AK Party fall into second behind the main opposition CHP in the nationwide vote. It failed badly in its attempt to regain Istanbul and Ankara, and it also lost control of a number of its traditional strongholds. We have a very rich conversation about what the CHP did right, what the AKP did wrong, the emerging challenge to the AKP posed by the hardline Islamist Yeniden Refah Party, or New Welfare Party, and the performance of the pro-Kurdish Dem Party. But before we get started, let me appeal for support. It takes a lot of time and effort to prepare the podcast, edit it, and put it out there, and I do need listeners' support, your support, to be able to keep going. We launched the podcast back in 2015, giving a platform to researchers and authors working on Turkish history, politics, society, literature, and the arts. Turkey Book Talk is completely independent with no sponsorships. It depends 100% on the goodwill of listeners like you. So if you are able to support, please consider doing so by becoming a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Supporting on Patreon is a nice thing to do, and it also gets you some pretty good extras. Those extras include a 35% discount on all books published in IB Taurus and Bloomsbury's Great Turkey and Ottoman History series. As a member, you get a special code to use at the online checkout, which you can use to purchase hundreds of Turkey and Ottoman history titles, either as an old-fashioned physical book or as an ebook. Turkey Book Talk members also receive a PDF transcript of every interview when the episode is published, and you also get transcripts of the entire archive of Turkey Book Talk interviews, including previously unpublished extras. And finally, to members, I also send links to a couple of articles related to the subject of the episode upon publication, which is ideal if you want to delve that bit deeper. To become a member, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon page and pledge $3, €3, or £2.50 per episode. You can pledge more if you want, but whatever you pledge, membership is entirely at your own discretion. It's inflation proof and there are no strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now on to our conversation with Seda Demiralp. The local election results took many people by surprise, including myself, to be honest. So I started by asking her whether she too was surprised and what was her initial reaction on election night.
Everybody was surprised. Even people who expected an opposition victory were surprised about the magnitude of the victory. I was expecting the opposition to win in cities like Istanbul and Ankara, and obviously some other cities too. But the fact that so many cities that used to be under the AK Party's control shifted to the opposition, including some highly conservative Anatolian cities, that was surprising. I have been working on political apathy, voter alienation, particularly since the last election. So I was not surprised to see this low turnout, low in Turkish standards, of course. 78% is relatively low in Turkey. The last elections, 2023 elections, participation rate was more than 87% or so. But the surprising part of the low turnout was the way it was distributed. A lot of people were expecting opposition voters to be staying at home and not paying so much attention and not really going and voting because of the heartbreaking impact of the 2023 elections. I've been arguing that alienation is mutual. I was part of a survey study conducted in October where we measured that political apathy, political alienation, and a loss of interest in politics applied to both AK Party and CHP voters in Istanbul. And lately, actually 1 month before the elections, I was directing this focus group study on apathy again. So there also I was observing that apathy is nonpartisan. partisan, and voters from both sides are feeling very alienated from politics for different reasons. For incumbent voters, it was mostly about continuing economic problems. Incumbent voters have been expressing their frustration with the fact that they've been giving credit to the government election after election, but their economic problems continue. And opposition voters were frustrated that they never win, their parties never win, especially in 2023. A lot of people, a lot of opposition voters, opposition actors, they thought opposition must win because all the structural conditions were ripe for change, but opposition lost anyway, and a lot of apathy among opposition voters had increased after 2020 elections, therefore. But after Kılıçdaroğlu left office and he was replaced by Özgür Özel, who opened more room for names like İmamoğlu and Yavaş, things started to change, and it looks like this played an important role in bringing back apathetic opposition voters to the ballot box. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this low turnout was somewhat expected. It wasn't really expected by many, however, that it would be distributed so asymmetrically, with incumbent voters staying at home on election day and opposition voters going more to the ballot box. And I think this pretty much explains why the AK Party lost so much.
And I suppose, obviously, what we've seen since Sunday is enthusiasm seems to be now back on the menu among opposition voters. And obviously, one of the main headline-grabbing successes was the re-election of Ekrem İmamoğlu in Istanbul just a few months ago. It looked like he was facing a very tough challenge in this election due to various structural factors about opposition fragmentation, etc. But he won regardless, and won by a much larger margin than previously. So he's obviously now being touted as a future presidential candidate in years to come, challenger to Erdogan potentially. And, you know, this is obviously a long road ahead of him, complicated road given the circumstances. But broadly, how do you see his path forward from here? Do you share the assumption that he is, you know, number one contender for the opposition presidential candidacy in 2028? Or what are his prospects?
Well, he proved himself one more time, right? He won Istanbul elections before, twice actually. So this is the third time he's winning against an Erdogan-backed AKP candidate. And against all odds, like you're saying, this time compared to 2019, there was no coalition among opposition parties. So even though there is no agreement between parties, there is no official coalition. So İmamoğlu managed to form a coalition at voters level when there was no coalition at parties level. That's big. And, you know, he won with a much larger margin this time compared to 2019. So that's also huge. By the way, it's not just him, obviously. Mansur Yavaş in Ankara, he also won a major victory. And I think both are potential presidential candidates for 2028. So both İmamoğlu and Yavaş were very successful. They increased their votes from 2019 to 2024. But I think their success is not limited to the cities where they won. Both of them energized opposition voters throughout Turkey, and both of them attracted votes from the AK Party as well. So that's important. We talk about AK Party voters not going to the ballot box on the election day, which is true. So the low turnout among AKP voters is an important part of the story. But some of them did go and vote, but they voted for opposition candidates. And I think İmamoğlu and Yavaş played an important role there. They played an important role in changing CHP's image. CHP's more rigidly secularist, I guess, and more left-leaning image. And they provided a more inclusionary CHP for less partisan AKP voters. So I think that's important. And I think both of them are potential presidential candidates for the next general elections.
I guess some listeners will be wondering about the fate of legal cases that were opened against İmamoğlu, a number of prosecutions that he's appealed against, obviously. And the widespread opinion is that these are politically motivated cases, but they remain a kind of sword of Damocles hanging over his head. Potentially, I mean, how do you see those cases developing?
Well, I would be surprised to see the government pushing these cases with such a high public support behind İmamoğlu. I think it would be politically very damaging for Erdogan to push court cases and to use judiciary as a political weapon against İmamoğlu. If you think about Erdogan's balcony speech on the election night, he was very clear about his decision to accept election results. Of course, in general, I wouldn't be surprised if Erdogan changed his mind. But I seriously think with such a high support behind İmamoğlu, it wouldn't be easy to eliminate him using a court case. I don't think that Erdogan would choose to be remembered like that. He would love to win over him or beat him with elections, pushing court cases, using court cases against him. I personally don't think that would be the way he would choose to go.
And one of the other main themes that emerged from the election was obviously the rise, really, of the Yeniden Refah Party, which you could probably translate as the New Welfare Party, this upstart Islamist party, really to the right of the AKP, pushing this critical line, having supported Erdogan in last year's presidential elections. In this year's local elections, they ran mayoral candidates across the country and really attacked the AKP's record on a number of issues, economic issues, social issues. And like I say, a pretty hardline party pressuring Erdogan from the right, basically. So they were obviously very critical about economic conditions, but also they're very far to the right, really, on social issues. So very hardline on the LGBT issue. And they've also really did weaponize the criticism of the government over its lack of action, allegedly, on Israel, Gaza. So that was an issue, even though it was just a local election. That was something that resonated, I think, with at least a portion of conservative voters who perhaps previously had supported the AKP. So obviously, this is a new novel challenge to Erdogan's right. Obviously, Erdogan, you know, in his balcony speech, he talked about self-criticism. He talked about learning from mistakes after the election, trying to respond to what the message that the voters gave. I suppose one possible scenario is that he'll now try to close that gap with the New Welfare Party, try to chase their voters and become even more hardline on a number of these issues in the coming period. Do you see that as likely, or just broadly, how do you see the ruling alliance around Erdogan responding to this new challenge?
Well, yeah, Yeniden Refah, with the votes it received, you know, about 6% of national votes, and usually in local elections, small parties don't receive that much support, you know, because in local elections, candidates are running for just one seat, so people vote for the biggest, largest candidates. So 6% in a local election is a big deal. So Yeniden Refah really provided an address for disappointed AK Party voters who are not willing to vote for CHP and also did not want to stay at home on election day. So Yeniden Refah criticized the AK Party in its economic policies, particularly the pensioners and also, you know, like other wage earners, about economy, about, like you said, about Erdogan's relatively passive position in the Palestinian conflict, and also about other social issues like women, for instance, about the 6284 law that regulates divorce and alimony issues. So this is it's a good question, because a lot of people in Turkey today, particularly opposition parties and actors and voters, they celebrate election results, sometimes assuming that election results suggest many former AK Party voters this time did not vote for the AK Party because they moved moved closer to CHP, you know, politically. They feel warmer to CHP's agenda, you know, like secularism and women's rights. And to some extent, it may be true, but we do know some AKP voters did vote for CHP candidates. Sometimes that's because CHP candidates were just stronger candidates, more charismatic and capable-looking candidates. And some AKP voters probably voted for them because they were not happy with some of the AKP's policies about secularism or women's rights, and they did want a more maybe a liberal stance there. But some of them didn't vote for the AK party, and they voted for Yenidan Rafa instead because they thought AK party was not conservative enough or was not defending Muslim interests as strongly as it should be. So I think we should be cautious when we try to make predictions about how AK party will respond to this election failure. Will it move to the right or will it move to the left? It's not so certain yet. A lot of people almost immediately argue that AK party will open up, will embrace reforms. And then some of AK party officials did signal that they will consider making reforms. But what are going to be those reforms, you know? I've been reading some of the stuff AK party supporters have been writing on social media. And really, I was really surprised about how they interpreted the election results. A lot of people think it was a mistake that the AK party remained deaf almost to the outcry of more conservative voters about the Palestinian issue, about the women's issue, and about the economy. The economic issues are nonpartisan. People from almost all parties complain about the pain and suffering of wage earners under high inflation, but about the other issues, especially about women's rights. Because I could say the Palestinian issue is almost a nonpartisan issue as well. Throughout Turkey, people sympathize with Palestinians. But about women's rights, that's a divisive issue. Women's rights, that's different. But yeah, we should see how AK Party will respond and if they will choose to close the gap between themselves and Yenidan Rafa, or try to win some of their voters who move to CHP and embrace a more progressive agenda.
Another area where the new welfare party, the Yenidan Rafa party, challenged the AK party was obviously, as we say, over the economy. And, you know, looking at their campaigning, it doesn't really have a very coherent or very comprehensive economic program, but it did mobilize discontent over that issue, over high inflation, rising interest rates, and really did mobilize that among poorer urban voters, it seems, and in small towns across Turkey. And some have pointed to this as a developing trend with, you know, this party increasingly gaining a foothold, it seems, in poorer working class conservative urban areas and provincial towns and cities across Anatolia, and obviously gaining a huge number of members as well in recent years. I think it just passed the 500,000 mark in terms of member numbers. And it's really developed this strong on the ground presence, actually similar in a way to how the old Welfare Party and indeed the AKP built up from the ground from, you know, the 1980s, 1990s and beyond. So kind of almost revivifying that tradition of Islamist parties. Is that a dynamic we should look out for as well? You know, this kind of strong ground presence, active on the district level, on the neighborhood level among the Yeniden Refa party. And how could that develop in the months and years ahead, I suppose?
Yeah, well, the AK party in the past has been quite successful in harnessing the interests of both low-income and high-income voters, not the middle class, but both low- and high-income groups. That is not really the case today. Even in 2023 elections, the above inflation increase in the minimum wage and some other distribution, some other benefits that the AK party passed to its low-income voters, that played a role in AK party winning elections again in the middle of an economic crisis. But even over the past 10 months, we saw how AK party's distributive mechanism is failing. So our party has been less and less able to shift revenues to low-income groups. And with the high inflation, the benefits you pass just evaporate so quickly, so they are never enough. And that's what Erdogan himself said, you know, when people pressured him, when pensioners pressured him for an increase in retirement salaries, he said, well, one, there's no money left. He never said that so openly and directly before, but this time he said it. And second, he said, with this high inflation rate, even if he increased retirement salaries, it wouldn't really make a significant difference. So the solution is to bring down the inflation rate. And that's what the opposition has been arguing for all these years. You know, that's what many of us have been arguing. And it's only populist policies to just keep increasing these like minimum wage and other wages. You don't fight poverty this way and you don't fight inflation this way, obviously. So now, all of a sudden, Erdogan is becoming more rational about economic policies and less populist. I think that's because there's no money left. And Mehmet Şimşek is probably saying he can't go that way. So there is a void now. The low-income interests are not met. And CHP is trying to appeal to these voters, but historically, because of its baggage, it's a secularist baggage, it has a problem in reaching these voters. So Yeniden Refah has some advantages there because culturally, ideologically, Yeniden Refah can touch these people and speak their language. So it's too soon to say Yeniden Refah may replace AK Party one day or will be, you know, like just more popular than it is now. But it is becoming a significant actor and we should take Erbakan seriously. We should not underestimate his existence and what he's trying to do and where he is trying to move Turkish policy. And yeah, I mean, we'll see if AK Party will try to close the gap between itself and Yeniden Refah or between itself and CHP. During the elections, AK Party antagonized Yeniden Refah big time. And I think that was a strategic mistake. Yeniden Refah was trying to establish its difference from the AK Party, right? Because, I mean, Yeniden Refah and AK Party have a common voter base. People who vote for these two parties, they would agree about, out of 10, they would agree about 8 topics and maybe 2 topics they would disagree, such as the economy and maybe the women's rights, but just even not in these issues, you know, they wouldn't differ significantly. But Yeniden Refah has been trying to highlight these differences. So AK Party antagonizing Yeniden Refah and, you know, but being so harsh about, speaking so harshly about Yeniden Refah leaders and what they are doing, I think they further emphasized Yeniden Refah and their position and the difference between AK Party and Yeniden Refah. I think if AK Party had ignored Yeniden Refah, it would be able to make Yeniden Refah more invisible. But by antagonizing Yeniden Refah, it highlighted the fact that Yeniden Refah is an address for conservative voters who are not very happy with what the AK Party is doing, although they are okay with AK Party's overall conservative vision. So if AK Party realizes that it was a mistake to antagonize Yeniden Refah, then they would try to close the gap between the two parties. And then we would see AK Party moving further to the right. But that would also be costly because some AKP voters moved towards the left and they voted for CHP. So it's not an easy decision. It's not going to be an easy decision. I think if AK Party moves closer to Yeniden Refah, it will continue to fail urban middle-class voters who voted for CHP in Istanbul and Ankara in particularly. But we'll see which voters they will prefer, which voters they will target.
And more broadly, I suppose, on the economy, this local election took place in a different set of circumstances, actually, to the election of May 2023, because obviously since that May 2023 election, Erdogan has done this 180 shift to quote-unquote orthodox economic policies. So once again, raising interest rates to try and bring down inflation, a number of measures in terms of the currency, trying to, you know, not so obviously sell the foreign currency reserves in order to support the lira, so letting the lira devalue further. Obviously, that's a painful process for a lot of people, and it's going to be painful going forward as well. And there's now, obviously, given these election results, there's a bit of speculation about the future of this policy, this return to orthodoxy, even questions about the fate of Mehmet Şimşek and his team. Erdogan, in his election speech on election night, he appeared to voice backing for this current course that they're on for Şimşek and these orthodox policies. But what do you think about that? I mean, should we expect any changes on that front? Is that sort of one area where Erdogan might be tempted to assuage the criticism from the grassroots and sort of return to the more familiar populist economic measures that we saw in previous years?
Yeah. We don't know, obviously, but he said he will continue supporting Mehmet Şimşek's policies. And I think the reason is that there is no other way left, you know, like Mehmet Şimşek said, all other options were exhausted. I think one of the reasons why Erdogan came to an end of redistributive populist economic policies is because he can no longer access Istanbul's land rents. Losing Istanbul in 2019 was very costly for Erdogan, and not just symbolically, but also economically. Istanbul is home to very precious land, and using Istanbul's land rents, Erdogan has been able to shift revenues to both low-income voters and also like a small group of top construction companies. So basically his constituencies from the lowest and highest end of the economic spectrum, often at the cost of middle-income groups, urban middle class. So sometimes by opening land to development, like some forest areas, beaches, some historical sites even, and sometimes allowing redevelopment of already developed areas and using the rent generated to finance its redistributive populist machinery. So not being able to do that over the past years, that was really costly for Erdogan. And I think the reason why he wanted to win Istanbul back so bad was to regain access to these revenues. Because, you know, how are you going to finance populist policies, economic populist policies, when you don't have like oil rents like oil rich countries? He used to use this, the land rents. So now that he knows he won't have access to these rents for another term, I think he cannot plan to go back to populist policies. And all other revenues, I mean, we ran out of other revenues as well. I mean, Mehmet Şimşek has been very clear about that. Really, there is no resources left even for groups who have been waiting for some improvement in their conditions, like the pensioners. So I don't think now deviating from orthodox policies and going back to the, you know, Nabati area, to those heterodox policies, I don't think that's an option. I mean, just going back there will be like starting all over again. And just, I don't see a point doing that, because we know that this will be the end point. I mean, it didn't work fighting inflation with high interest. All the economists, respected economies, were saying it's fighting inflation with low interest rates was not possible. He insisted, Erdogan insisted that this was possible, but in the end, he had to admit that it didn't work. So what's the point in going back to that road? I don't think he can convince anyone this time. What can be done is this time to place the costs on not the poor, but on the rich, you know, tax the rich, or, you know, make the rich pay the costs, because average voters have been paying the costs of high inflation, while some groups did benefit from the high inflationary environment. And all these people who obtained these cheap credits that other people were denied. So the benefits of high inflation were transferred to a certain group of people, while the costs were placed on, first of all, mid-income wage earners. So I think the only thing that can be done to fix the situation to some extent, stay in the within the limits of orthodox policies, but at the same time respond to some of the needs of the voters, would be to rethink structural reforms, make structural reforms, and redistribute the costs of the bitter drug. So yeah, I don't think he can go back to heterodox economic policies, but a neoliberal belt tightening type of program is also not really sustainable politically because it's costing him voters. So the middle ground, I think, is to stay within the limits of orthodox policies, but support that program with structural reforms and perhaps rethink tax policies, because Turkish tax system is very unfriendly to mid-income taxpayers, the highest income groups paying relatively low income tax. Tax burden is disproportionately placed on middle income, especially like white collar mid-income taxpayers. So an improvement, if we see an improvement there, I could raise my hopes about the prospects of Turkish economy. But otherwise, I don't see any other solution that, you know, like a solution that will fix the economy and at the same time not alienate too many voters.
Another key issue emerging from the election, obviously, was the performance of the Dem Party, the kind of latest iteration of the pro-Kurdish party in Turkey. This was its first election contested in this form, and nominated mayoral candidates both in East and Southeastern Turkey, but also elsewhere, obviously in Istanbul as well. We were talking about the Yeniden Refah Party earlier. It won over 60% of the vote nationwide and actually pushed the Dem Party into being the fourth most popular party in the country, according to the vote share. So the results seem like a bit of a mixed bag for the Dem Party in terms of its performance. It won back a number of the municipalities in Eastern and Southeastern Turkey that had previously had trustees basically replacing previously elected Kurdish mayors. So that was a success. But there was also, I think, something that you've mentioned as well, there was also a lack of enthusiasm detected by pollsters before the election. And indeed, the numbers weren't really stunning in terms of support for the party. And obviously in Istanbul, of course, its vote share was much lower than expectations. It seems like a lot of Dem Party supporters ended up supporting in the mayoral vote İmamoğlu. So it seems like there's also a divided approach within the party at the moment, different strategies, some focusing on a more Kurdish nationalist line and the other wing kind of continuing to reach out to other constituencies. We're talking on a day when the local election board ruled to give Van Province's election the mandate to the AKP's candidate, despite him finishing in a distant second for technical legal reasons. So there's that obvious prospect that the government may now decide to reinstate the trustee system following these elections. So that's another question going forward that we'll have to keep an eye on. But how did you weigh up the Dem Party's local electoral performance? Did they overperform or did they underachieve expectations?
Yeah, a lot of people were following how the party and their voters will behave in the elections, because the Kurdish votes were very important. In 2023, we talked about the Kurds as potential kingmakers, and in 2024, we repeated that. Looking at election results, I guess I can say that DEM maintained its control over Kurdish voters in the Kurdish populated southeast, but in larger cities and big cities like Istanbul, for instance, the connection between voters, Kurdish voters and DEM party is a bit more loose. Looking at DEM's votes in Istanbul, we can, I guess, say that about 50% of potential DEM voters voted for other parties, like most likely for CHP, for İmamoğlu, basically. Part of it is because of how İmamoğlu acted during the campaign. I guess I could say İmamoğlu managed to connect to Kurdish voters, and not necessarily by proposing a solution to the Kurdish issue or how he would solve the Kurdish issue if one day he would be president or as the mayor of Istanbul, but more like at an emotional level or interpersonal level. Like, he said things like, it's a shame he doesn't speak any Kurdish. He wishes he spoke at least some Kurdish to communicate with Kurdish Istanbulites. That was important. That was important. That was smart too, you know. It was a narrow road, thin road to walk to connect to Kurdish voters and Dem voters, while at the same time not alienating nationalist, Turkish nationalist voters. And I think İmamoğlu managed that really by using like emotions politics, you know. He used his own personality, his charisma, emotional language to connect to both voters without defending a nationalist or pro-Kurdish discourse, right? Without really saying anything that would alienate the other side. He was able to win hearts and minds of people from both sides. So I think that's part of why he secured at least half of them voters. And I think part of it is because Dem Party let this happen, you know, you could say that too. If they nominated Başak Demirtaş, for instance, instead of Meral Danış Beştaş, we could say probably more Kurdish voters would vote for Dem's candidate than they did this time. So I think Dem was somewhat okay with what happened. It's also a fact that Dem is not a homogenous party. Like you're saying, there is Kurdish nationalists and more pro-Turkification groups, like Demirtaş, for instance. And I think the younger generation of Kurds, especially like in big cities, like urban, young Kurdish voters are more in favor of a pro-Turkey or Turkification agenda that Demirtaş promotes, rather than a more Kurdish nationalist agenda. So,
yeah, and I suppose that neatly takes us to the final question, really, to wrap up. Obviously, a lot of people are viewing this local election as almost a return to politics, you know, a return to competition, even a comeback for democracy. But Erdogan still has control over pretty much all state resources, most of the media, the judiciary, etc. So, I mean, what's your reflection broadly on that? Is it right to see these local election results as the kind of resurrection of politics in Turkey and proof that things, despite everything that we've seen in recent years, still actually being up for grabs, basically?
Well, election results are phenomenal. It's phenomenal. It's a historical turn in Turkish politics. This opposition victory definitely should not be underestimated, and definitely it will be consequential, I think. It would be very costly for the government to ignore opposition victory and just continue doing what it would do. I don't think this is the more likely option. Obviously, AK Party is not a homogenous party, and there will be different groups who feel like responding differently to election failure. Some people will suggest that AK Party should tighten its grip on power as a response, but other people will think, other people will say, ignoring criticism, public criticism, will further erode the party's base. And I have reasons to be optimistic and think that overall, the more reformist groups will dominate. If that's the case, if I'm not wrong there, I would see a continuity in normalization. Not consistently, it will not always be consistent. So it will be normalization in some areas and then, you know, going back to the trustee system and other violations of freedoms and rights of expression. So it will not be consistent normalization road, but I think we'll see these windows. Because otherwise, AK Party will face further decline. So yeah, that's my perhaps a little bit optimistic interpretation.
That was Seda Demiralp. Many thanks to her for joining for episode 216. Remember, we do need your support to keep Turkey Book Talk going, and you can give that support by joining as a Turkey Book Talk member on Patreon. Membership gets you a 35% discount on all Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury, transcripts of every interview, transcripts of the entire archive of interviews, and links via email to articles and other content related to the subject of each episode. For all that, just go to Turkey Book Talk's Patreon account and pledge $3, €3, or £2.50 per episode. Do also rate the podcast or write a positive review wherever you listen. Spread the word, give us a shout out on your own social media accounts. Follow via our website, turkeybooktalk.com, our Twitter/X, Facebook or Instagram accounts, or all of them. Recommend Turkey Book Talk to a friend or a foe. And I always enjoy hearing from listeners, so do send any feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. And finally, let me once again remind you to check out a friend of Turkey Book Talk, Turkey Recap. Turkey Recap is a weekly email newsletter that brings together all major developments in Turkey over the past 7 days, links to interesting articles, and some excellent puns. They've got a Slack channel for signed up members who want more, and they also publish high quality original on the ground reporting, of which they've done much throughout the whole local election process. Just go to turkeyrecap.com and follow the links there to subscribe. But until our next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.